Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the July 24th, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a classroom scene. There are three children in the classroom. They're pretty spaced out. They're all wearing masks, and each has an individual bottle of hand sanitizer on the front. The whiteboard in the background has some messages on it. There's a picture of the coronavirus. It says, no touching, wear your mask. It shows a picture of distancing. And the young girl in the foreground just has a really worried look in her eyes. The title is Back to School, Weighing the Risks and Benefits of Having Kids Return to the Classroom. And that is indeed our first main story. We'll start right there. The dilemma over opening schools. What happened? City, state, and county leaders across the U.S. wrestled with a wrenching question this week, whether and how they can safely reopen their schools amid a raging pandemic. Despite pressure from President Donald Trump and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos to open as usual, some of the country's largest school districts announced plans to continue online schooling this fall or offer staggered schedules that would put children in school some days and online others. A strategy with major ramifications for working parents. Cities offering such hybrid plans include New York, Seattle, and Miami. Nashville, Atlanta, Oakland, San Diego, and Los Angeles were among those announcing plans to resume total online schooling, at least at first, due to surging coronavirus infections. It's disappointing, said Los Angeles School Superintendent Austin Beutner, but there's a public health imperative to keep schools from becoming a petri dish. Both Trump and DeVos have insisted the nation's 56 million school children must return to five-day-a-week classes this fall and threaten to withhold federal funding for school districts that do not comply. Hybrid schedules are not a valid choice for families, said DeVos. Kids need to be in school. Trump pushed back against CDC safety guidelines that include temperature checks, modifying classrooms to allow for 6 feet between students, and closing common spaces such as cafeterias. Such measures are very impractical, Trump tweeted. His administration's push to reopen classrooms faces resistance not only from teachers' unions, but from some parents. In an Axios poll, 71% of parents called it risky. Looming over the debate are unsettled questions about just how much risk there is. Elementary school children appear to be at low risk of serious illness, but it's less clear if they can spread infections to their parents, teachers, and other adults. Teens have been found to be more infectious. Many European schools have resumed without outbreaks. But in Israel, schools that reopened without distancing measures in May were shuttered after hundreds of children and teachers were infected. Those outbreaks helped fuel a current coronavirus surge in Israel. The sequence was entirely predictable, said Hebrew University epidemiologist Haggai Levine. What the editorial said, Trump is making a tough situation worse with threats and recrimination, said the Dallas Morning News. As school officials strike a delicate balance between serving students and keeping communities safe, his calls to ignore safety guidelines and cut funding are the last thing they need. and will make coaxing concerned teachers and students back into the classroom more difficult. The evidence argues overwhelmingly for schools to reopen, said the Wall Street Journal. Young children have relative immunity to the coronavirus. Only 30 kids under 15 have died from COVID-19, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Meanwhile, kids have struggled with virtual education, losing ground that soon will be impossible to make up, especially for low-income and special needs students. Children need school for their academic and emotional development, and working parents, essential to the economy, need to have their kids in school. Teachers and administrators have a duty to make it happen. What the columnist said. We can do this safely, said Scott Gottlieb in the Wall Street Journal, but it requires prudence and flexibility. Desks should be set apart, masking should be universal, and pooled testing of students and teachers should be considered to detect imminent outbreaks. Hand-washing stations must become fixtures. Teachers should be given protective equipment, and staggered schedules should be adopted where needed to reduce overcrowding. These measures are costly, and districts will need financial and technical support. As battle lines are drawn, one voice is glaringly absent, said Elena Rabinowitz in CNN.com, that of teachers like me. I work in New York City, where more than 75 education department workers have died in the pandemic. I love teaching, but I don't want to be next. To enable distancing, students' schedules need to be staggered, with some at-home learning, and class space needs to be expanded into libraries and government buildings. If we are going to risk our lives, educators need federal and state officials to provide support, flexibility, and money, not control. I'm both a father and an epidemiologist, and I think schools should reopen, said Benjamin Linus in Vox.com. It's a nightmare choice plagued by uncertainty, and like every parent, I'm worried. But the decision boils down to this. The risks of reopening are uncertain, while the devastating cost to kids and parents of not opening are clear. This agonizing choice wasn't inevitable, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. European and Asian countries chose to drive down infection rates with distancing, masking, and lockdowns, and can now reopen schools fairly safely. But in the U.S., we turned masks into a front on the culture war, and many governors rushed to reopen bars and restaurants and let people party. Essentially, America drank away its children's future, and the nation will suffer permanent damage. Controversy of the week is titled Freeing Stone, Trump's Most Corrupt Act Yet. When President Trump last week commuted the prison sentence of Roger Stone, said Matt Ford in NewRepublic.com, he cemented his status as the most corrupt president in history. Stone, 67, was facing 3 years and 4 months in jail for lying to Congress and witness tampering to hide his and Trump's knowledge of Russian hacking operations during the 2016 presidential campaign. But now Trump has made good on his implicit promise to Stone when he praised him for being very brave in defying prosecutors and not flipping. Usually, witness tampering and obstruction like this takes place in hushed conversations behind closed doors. Trump's greatest innovation is to carry out his corrupt acts in plain sight. Trump's cover-up succeeded, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. Stone worked with the Foreign Intelligence Service to help elect his old chum president, a grave and unprecedented betrayal of this country. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigators unearthed damning evidence that Stone had frequent and direct communication with Russian military intelligence and WikiLeaks about stolen Democratic emails, which he then shared with Trump. Stone's lies about that treasonous scheme have now been rewarded in what will be remembered as one of the greatest scandals in American history. Spare us the righteous indignation, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. Yes, Roger Stone is a whack job, but there is still no evidence that either Stone or Trump had anything to do with the hacking of Democratic emails. Trump has hardly been coy about his disgust that those targeted in the Russia hoax were treated unfairly. In the sordid history of presidential pardons, the Stone commutation looks positively chaste, said Jonathan Turley in TheHill.com. Have we forgotten that President Clinton erased his own brother's conviction for cocaine possession? Or pardoned fugitive financier Mark Rich after he donated $450,000 to the Clinton Library? Most of us remember, said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times, but we also recall that the right was furious about those pardons. Republicans held angry hearings into the Clinton pardon of Rich, while liberals denounced it too. This week, by contrast, only GOP Senators Mitt Romney and Pat Toomey joined Democrats in criticizing Stone's commutation, while the rest remained silent or even defended it. Other presidents have issued shameful pardons to friends and allies, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. But none, until Trump, ever used his pardon power to protect himself. This precise scenario deeply concerned the framers as they debated giving the president such a sweeping power. James Madison assured them that if pardons were used to cover up crimes involving the president himself, the House of Representatives can impeach him. Republicans should take Madison's recommendation, said Jonathan Bernstein in Bloomberg.com. Stone's commutation gives the GOP an escape hatch, a chance to ditch the increasingly toxic Trump and fight the 2020 election behind a relatively unblemished President Mike Pence. Is it going to happen? Of course not. And that failure will likely be punished harshly in November. Who knows what Trump will do between now and then, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. Rewarding Stone for his cover-up hardly marks the ethical nadir for a president who pretends a pandemic isn't happening and pours salt into America's racial wounds. In trying to fathom the lowest moment of the Trump presidency, one answer is almost always correct. Tomorrow. Let's see what we've got in our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for potted plants, which occupied every seat in Barcelona's Gran Teatre de l'Issue for the first post-coronavirus performance of the Ussoli String Quartet. In a statement, the venue hailed the performance as a highly symbolic act that defends the value of art, music, and nature. It was a good week for surrendering to reality. After President Trump donned a face mask for the first time in public, while visiting wounded soldiers at Walter Reed Medical Center. Trump had previously derided mask wearing as political correctness. It was a good week for going beyond masks after a Toronto-based maker of protective gear introduced a $250 hazmat-like helmet and upper body suit for airplane passengers and others who venture into crowded public spaces. VYZR Technologies quickly received 50,000 orders. But it was a bad week for monuments to great achievers. After unknown arsonists set fire to a crude wooden statue of Melania Trump in her hometown of Sevnica, Slovenia. I want to know why they did it, said Brad Downey, the American artist who commissioned the statue. It was a bad week for patio ambiance, with reports from New York City that starving rats are pestering outdoor restaurant diners. Deprived of restaurant trash for months, the city's rats are simply desperate. rodentologist Dr. Bobby Corrigan told Gothamist.com. It's biology 101. And finally, it was a bad week for the Southwest, which is baking in a brutal heat wave as it struggles with a huge coronavirus surge. Temperatures reached 115 degrees in Phoenix, 110 in West Texas, and 128 in Death Valley, California. Only 1.2 degrees lower than the all-time planetary record. Before we move on, here's a short news piece. GOP may move its convention outdoors. President Trump is moving forward with plans to hold the Republican National Convention in Florida in late August, despite the state's coronavirus outbreak and fears of hosting a potential super spreader event. Even as Trump insisted on something that will be great, GOP officials scouted outdoor alternatives. Since the event was moved from Charlotte, North Carolina, Jacksonville, Florida has imposed the same restrictions, mandated face masks in public and social distancing indoors, that caused Trump to flee to Florida in the first place. While the RNC said it has adequate funds for a Florida convention, many headliners in the party either said they would skip the event, like Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, remained noncommittal. Everybody just assumes no one is going, said Representative Darren LaHood, a Republican from Illinois. We're on the briefing page. The title of that article is China's Growing Belligerence. China has been throwing its weight around from Hong Kong to India. Why the new aggression? What is China doing? In the past few months, Beijing has exploited the U.S.'s and the world's preoccupation with the coronavirus pandemic to assert China's hegemony throughout Asia. It has threatened or sunk boats from Vietnam, the Philippines, Japan, and Malaysia, and flown fighter jets into Taiwanese airspace 8 times. It instigated a skirmish with India in the Himalayas that killed dozens, the worst such fighting along the disputed border in decades. It's a quite deliberate Chinese strategy to try to maximize what they perceive as being a moment of distraction, said Peter Jennings of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Beijing has also been emboldened by Trump's America First isolationism, Jennings said. In passing a draconian security law for Hong Kong, Beijing shredded all pretense that it would keep its pledge to respect the former British colony's one country, two systems arrangement, or Hong Kongers' right to free speech. Its domestic oppression of its mostly Muslim Uyghur minority became more gruesome with the recent revelation of a campaign to prevent Uyghur births through forced birth control and abortion. How is China's military involved? Chinese Coast Guard vessels have been muscling into other countries' territorial waters all over the South China Sea, a body of water China claims as its sole domain, even though 9 other countries also border it. In April, the Chinese rammed and sank a Vietnamese fishing boat, harassed Malaysian and Philippine ships, and declared that lands long claimed by the Philippines, including the Spratly Islands, Scarborough Shoal, and Fiery Cross Reef, were now Chinese districts. In June, it menaced Taiwan with bombers and fighter jets in Taiwanese airspace, a rare occurrence before this year. But the military isn't China's only tool. It is also exerting its economic might and its soft power. How is Beijing doing that? When Australia asked for an international investigation into how the coronavirus spread from Wuhan to the world, China's wrath was swift. It hit Australia with a shocking 80% tariff on barley and a ban on beef imports, and launched a huge cyber attack on all levels of Australian government. Meanwhile, conservative lawmakers in Australia and the U.S. have raised concerns about the growing penetration of the United Front, an arm of the Chinese government that sponsors Chinese cultural and educational groups all over the world. In Canada, for example, the Front mobilized Chinese groups to buy up masks and gloves in the early days of the pandemic and send them to China. Chinese President Xi Jinping calls the Front one of China's three magic weapons, along with the Communist Party and armed struggle. What is the global response? Other countries are enacting sanctions and reorienting their military strategies to confront the Chinese threat. The Philippines, which under President Rodrigo Duterte have been openly anti-American and deferential to China, has just changed course, deciding not to go through with a planned withdrawal from a military treaty with the U.S. Australia unveiled new military spending of $186 billion over the next 10 years, with a focus on deterring China itself rather than supporting U.S. missions. Britain is following suit. We need to work out how we will deal with a China that economically, technically, and militarily is going to surpass the U.S. within our lifetime, said Tobias Elwood, head of the Parliament's Defense Committee. What has the U.S. done? President Trump has reversed his early prey of Xi on the coronavirus response, now blaming China for worldwide killing. In May, his administration canceled visas for Chinese grad students with links to the Communist Party. More recently, the Pentagon sent three aircraft carriers to the region and conducted huge exercises in the South China Sea involving dozens of ships and hundreds of warplanes. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has criticized Beijing for aggressive expansionism. Congress passed the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act, which sanctions specific Chinese officials responsible for gross human rights violations, and it is planning to spend an additional $7 billion over 2 years to boost Pacific forces. Will that deter China? Nope. International criticism of China over the pandemic and Chinese aggression has only produced more swaggering defiance from Beijing, which believes it will soon surpass the U.S. as the world's great superpower. Xi Jinping's attitude now is that he can't fail, said Taiwanese defense analyst Huang Chung-ting. Xi is also emboldened by what he sees as a vacuum in American leadership. Chinese officials have openly cheered for Trump's re-election, saying that he is not only a weak leader, but also, through his incessant tweeting, easy to read, and therefore the best choice in an opponent for negotiations. Trump spurns alliances, so he won't lead an international effort to rein in Beijing, and he is openly indifferent to human rights abuses. Beijing knows, Chinese specialist Maxine Pai told The Atlantic, that Trump can be persuaded if the price is right. Time to read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with How Science May Beat the Virus. Even if a coronavirus vaccine is far off, said William Hazeltine, there is reason for hope that a medical solution to the crisis will soon be at hand. Scientists are now developing two types of drugs that show great promise. The first are antivirals that could keep the virus from replicating inside the body. The coronavirus uses a protein called active protease to copy itself inside cells, and researchers have already published studies on two drugs that bind this to protein and block reproduction in the test tube. Early testing on mice suggests the drug is both effective and non-toxic. The second class of drugs are monoclonal antibodies, which are lab-created antibodies designed to block the coronavirus spike proteins from attaching to cell receptors in our bodies. A monoclonal antibody cocktail of two drugs will soon begin late-stage trials. More testing is needed to prove these drugs' safety and effectiveness, but the review process is much faster than for vaccines. You can tell whether they work to reduce viral load in already infected patients within a matter of days. Antiviral and monoclonal antibody treatments that block infection and even treat the sick could be ready by early 2021. Science will eventually save us. Trump's racial strategy is failing. With polls showing his reelection prospects dimming, a desperate President Trump is playing the race card. But this time it's backfiring, said David Graham. In 2016, Trump eked out an Electoral College victory by stoking racial grievance among white Americans. But the police killing of George Floyd has created a major shift in race relations in this country. Rather than a just course by trying to expand his base, Trump is doubling down on race baiting. Last week, he criticized NASCAR for banning the Confederate flag at races and personally attacked the black driver, Bubba Wallace, who inspired the rule change. On Independence Day, Trump warned that angry mobs were erasing the country's heritage and said Americans will not allow our country and all of its values, history, and culture to be taken from them. Trump has long viewed himself not as the president of all Americans, but as the president of Trump voters. But a majority of voters are increasingly horrified by Trump's divisive rhetoric, with only 33% approving of his handling of race issues. In 2016, Trump won by exploiting the racial backlash to Barack Obama. Now the backlash to the backlash may doom his campaign. This is a column from Portugal. A city for workers, not tourists. The sudden collapse of tourism gives my city a chance to do things differently, said Lisbon Mayor Fernando Medina. Before the coronavirus hit, our 500,000 citizens were already in danger of becoming overwhelmed by mass tourism, with more than 4 million visitors arriving in our city every year. The advent of the pandemic made it crushingly clear that we have a housing crisis, because we found that essential workers and their families don't live anywhere near the city center. They have been forced out as Airbnb-style holiday rentals have taken over a third of Lisbon's city center properties, driven up housing costs, and hollowed out our communities. Without tourists, that prime real estate is now just sitting empty. So to bring Lisbon's lifeblood back, the city government is going to pay landlords to turn thousands of those short-term visitor rentals into long-term rentals for hospital workers, teachers, and other key government workers. Landlords will benefit by having steady, assured income, and the climate will benefit because workers won't have to drive when they can walk or bus to work. When tourists do return to Lisbon, they'll find a cleaner, greener, living city, rather than one that's in danger of becoming a beautiful museum. And we'll turn right over to the last word, our in-depth article. The title this week is A Newsman Who Won't Turn Out the Lights. For its hedge fund owners, Pottstown, Pennsylvania's paper, The Mercury, is a carcass to be picked clean, said Dan Barry in the New York Times. For a longtime reporter, it's still a calling and a way of life. An essential worker drove his cluttered Toyota Corolla through the early spring emptiness, past a sign outside a closed parochial school asking people to pray. Time to bear witness in a pandemic. He pulled up to the closed Lower Potts Grove Elementary School, where masked employees were distributing bags and boxes of food. Dozens of cars waited in line for curbside pickup. In the global context of the coronavirus, the moment was small. But to those who live around a Pennsylvania place called Pottstown, the scene reflected both the dependence on subsidized school meals and the yearning to connect in an unsettling time of isolation. It was a story. Evan Brandt, proud reporter for a once proud newspaper, the Mercury, emerged from his Toyota with press identification dangling from his neck, the photo old enough to be of someone else. The newspaper's last staff photographer left years ago, and Brandt, grayer and heavier at 55, had not updated his image. Forget dashing foreign correspondents and all the president's men. Daily journalism often comes down to local reporters like Brandt. Overworked, underpaid, and unlikely to appear as cable news pundits, they report the day's events, hold officials accountable, and capture those moments suitable for framing. But they are an endangered species being nudged toward extinction by the most important news story in decades, the coronavirus. The economic paralysis caused by the pandemic has clobbered a newspaper industry already on the mat. With revenues plummeting, substantial layoffs, furloughs, and pay reductions have followed in newsrooms across the country. Meanwhile, the hedge funds and private equity firms that own many newspapers often siphon away profits instead of reinvesting in local journalism. Frequently associated with this business model is the Allen Global Capital Hedge Fund, which controls the Mercury, Brandt's employer for 23 years. Nearly all of his colleagues who didn't quit have been laid off or bought out, effectively making him the last reporter covering Pottstown. His newspaper's distinctive building was abruptly emptied and later sold, so he works in his attic, surrounded by a display of 36 journalism awards, many for public service. "To remind me that the work is important," Brandt said. He keeps another memento as well, a photograph of the time he paid an unannounced visit to the Long Island, New York mansion of the president of Alden Global Capital. He had a question he needed to ask. If Thornton Wilder's Our Town were set in Pottstown, Evan Brandt would be the omniscient stage manager. Eyeglasses kept on a string, reporter's notebook waving from his back pocket. People stopped him to say hello or make some fake news joke or just ask what's the latest. He usually knows. Pottstown, a town of 23,000, about 40 miles northwest of Philadelphia, is like many American places, between acts. The iron and steel industries are all but gone, leaving the town's former prosperity to linger in the worn storefront grandeur along High Street. Brandt is responsible for covering more than a dozen governments and school districts. On one Tuesday this year, seven newsworthy public meetings were taking place simultaneously. Brandt was also juggling a congresswoman's town hall gathering, the Phoenixville School District's disproportionate suspension of students of color, and a proposal for 700 homes and several shopping centers in New Hanover. Brandt demonstrated his command of all things Pottstown during nickel tours of its 5 square miles in his 2014 Corolla. The interior is coffee-stained casual. Here was the former site of Mrs. Smith's Pies factory. The tins are still made in Pottstown. Here, the old Bethlehem steel plant. It still supports the Golden Gate Bridge. And here, in this old bank building, the Blue Elephant, one of several new restaurants in town. See this handsome brick building? Nearly 20 years ago, Brandt and a photographer exposed a chemical company's risky storage of hazardous materials, leading to the warehouse's closure. Now it is part of Montgomery County Community College. Brandt's meandering excursion finally came to a blonde brick building at the corner of North Hanover and King Streets. A vertical marquee identified this empty local landmark, the Mercury, named after the messenger of the gods, dedicated to being frank and fearless in all matters. The Mercury was imagined into reality in 1931 by Shandy Hill, a seasoned editor, and William Heaster, a young man with a passion for journalism, and, more essential, access to family wealth. For the next several decades, the Mercury abided by an understood compact. In exchange for some updated version of a coin pressed into a newsboy's ink-smudged hand, the newspaper provided you with information and context that could not be gleaned from reading school board minutes or watching local access television. The Mercury is the smallest newspaper to win two Pulitzer Prizes. Its editorial writer, Thomas J. Houghton, won the newspaper's second Pulitzer Prize in 1990 for essays that championed open space preservation to ward against suburban sprawl. Its first Pulitzer, though, reflected the intimacy between the newspaper and community. In 1979, Mercury photographer Tom Kelly III won for arresting images of a man on the loose and covered in blood, moments after he had killed his pregnant wife and attacked two family members. When the word of his award erupted in the newsroom, Kelly walked over to another Mercury employee sweeping the floor, the father of the slain young woman. He hugged the man and told him he was sorry. To understand Brandt, you should probably know that he was voted most individualistic at Pleasantville High School in New York's Westchester County. He graduated from college and worked at Suburban Weeklies before joining the Mercury in 1997. Soon after, the Goodson Newspaper Group sold it to Journal Register Company. The newsroom had a phalanx of editors, three photographers, a few sports writers, and several reporters writing hard news, soft features, and in-depth investigative pieces. They shared a sense of mission. Brandt never forgot the example set by staff photographers who would race to every fire and crime scene as though traffic laws did not apply on deadline. If you came back to the newsroom and you didn't smell like smoke, you hadn't done your job. Eventually, Brandt and his wife, Karen Maxville, bought a Victorian house in what is known as the Numbered Street section. Their one child, Dylan, attended Pottstown High School, where he would become salutatorian. Life and the news continued. In 2011, the Journal Register Company was bought by Alden Global Capital. The hedge fund's publicly shy owners, Randall D. Smith and Heath Freeman, were often referred to as vulture capitalists, having made their fortune by buying distressed properties. Newspaper acquisitions may not seem to make much business sense, given that readership and advertising have been declining for decades, but vultures feast on remnants. They're extracting significant profits, and they're not investing, said newspaper analyst Ken Doctor. When they can no longer extract a profit, or enough of a profit, they'll turn out the lights in Pottstown. Under Alden's ownership, rainwater often fell through the roof of the Mercury building. The sickening smell of mildew invaded from the stairwell. The desks by the Mercury editorial department signed emptied out. Finally, in May 2018, the company instructed the few remaining Mercury employees to vacate. The Pottstown newsroom for the Mercury moved to the third floor attic of the Maxville Brandt home. One day you're in Pottstown striving to keep up with the news. The next, you're standing outside a multi-million dollar mansion 240 miles from home, holding a handmade sign that says, "Invest in us or sell us." Such is the desperation of a frustrated newspaperman. In the spring of 2018, Brandt and his family visited his father and stepmother on eastern Long Island. Work worries, as always, accompanied him, the mildew, the colleagues who had left, the struggle to report everything that Pottstown needed to know, and, just added, a recent Newsonomics column by Doctor for Harvard University's Nieman Lab. Its headline, Alden Global Capital is making so much money wrecking local journalism, it might not want to stop anytime soon. Doctor reported that Alden's newspaper subsidiary had earned $160 million in 2017 fiscal year. This included $18 million at an astounding 30% profit margin from its Philadelphia area newspapers. Among them, the Mercury. The numbers, Brandt recalled, grilled my onions. Early on a sunlit afternoon, Brandt drove his Corolla to the Freeman Mansion. As Brandt was posing with his cardboard sign for a photograph to circulate on social media, a woman driving away from the home stopped to ask if he needed help. He asked if Freeman was home. She looked at his T-shirt and sign, said no, and drove away. But he could hear music echoing from the house. Brandt knocked on people's doors for a living, so why not knock on this one? But given Freeman's reputation for reticence, he knew he might get to ask only one question. His choice? What value do you place on local news? In other words, what is local news worth? Not in monetary terms, but in terms of an informed electorate, an accountable government, a sense of place. A woman who answered the door invited Brandt into the foyer and asked whether he was expected. Most certainly not, he said. Let us pause to note that of the many questions sent in writing to Alden Global Capital for this article, the only one its spokesman addressed concerned Freeman's recollection of the incident. They responded not by answering the question, but by referring to A.G. Sulzberger, publisher of the New York Times. Would the New York Times likely terminate the employment of a staff member who showed up randomly unannounced, demanding to question Sulzberger at his home? That's why we are unclear why the New York Times is choosing to glorify this improper, intrusive conduct. Back to Montauk. Brandt recalled that as he waited in the foyer, Freeman appeared upstairs, shirtless and with a baby in his arms. For a fleeting moment, the two men locked eyes. The fit, bare-chested multimillionaire and the rumpled newspaper man from Pottstown, who made 46 grand a year and had a question. Alden Global Capital shook its head and walked away. Outside the closed elementary school, the local effect of a global pandemic continued to play out. Brandt finished his interviews and headed toward his car. He passed a teacher he knew who was holding an I love you sign for her students. Living the dream, he asked. Not my dream, she answered. The quick exchange underscored how this was no dream. These are the new realities. Life has been transformed, and local newspapers, once central to that life, are diminished or gone. The vacant Mercury building was sold, as is, to a local engineer last year for $440,000. The plan is to convert it into a boutique hotel. Former Mercury employees were invited to take what they wanted before dumpsters received the accrued memories of a once proud newspaper. Brandt took some things, including a piece of copier paper bearing four words. He taped it to his attic door. The sign says this: The Mercury Editorial Department. A version of this was originally published in the New York Times. We'll read one of the obituaries this week. The comedy legend who happily played second fiddle, Carl Reiner, 1922 to 2020. Carl Reiner was a master at helping other comics shine. Tall and rubbery-faced, with a booming voice and a knack for foreign-sounding gibberish, he played second banana to Sid Caesar on Your Show of Shows, the 1950s comedy review known for its cutting-edge silliness. He was also a member of Caesar's storied writer's room, spitballing with Neil Simon, Mel Tolkien, Woody Allen, Mel Brooks, and other soon-to-be legends. The experience birthed a friendship with Brooks, whom Reiner would mock interview in their iconic bit, The 2,000-Year-Old Man, and inspired Reiner to create a sitcom about a variety show writer who lives in the New York suburbs. The pilot for Head of the Family, with Reiner in the lead role, was a flop. But recast with Dick Van Dyke as the star and Reiner playing his egomaniacal toupee-wearing boss, the sitcom became a roaring success. The Dick Van Dyke Show ran from 1961 to 1966 and has been in syndication ever since. "We got a better actor," Reiner said, "a much better actor." Reiner was born in the Bronx to immigrants from Eastern Europe, said the Times. According to family lore, his watchmaker father invented the first battery-operated clock, only to have the patent stolen by the Nazis. At age 16, Reiner was working as a mechanic when his older brother read about free acting classes provided by the Works Progress Administration, a New Deal agency. Reiner enrolled, and a new career beckoned. After touring the Pacific with an entertainment unit during World War II, he returned to the U.S. and starred in several Broadway musicals. In 1950, Caesar hired Reiner for his pioneering live TV sketch comedy programs at NPR.com, with Reiner as the straight man to Caesar's eccentric characters. "Being a second banana to such a massive first banana," said Reiner, "wasn't a come down at all." He also lit the comedy fuse for Brooks in the 2,000-Year-Old Man routine, feeding questions to the ancient sage in a routine the pair would initially perform only for friends at dinner parties, said the Washington Post. Brooks, ad-libbing in a Yiddish accent, reminisced about his thousands of children they never visit. Jesus, thin lad, wore sandals, always walked around with 12 other guys. And Sigmund Freud, a good basketball player. Reiner thought mainstream audience would reject their Jewish humor, but when they put it on record, the first of five albums sold 1 million copies. Film star Cary Grant said when he played the LP at Buckingham Palace, the Queen Mother roared with laughter. "Well, there's the biggest shishka in the world," Reiner told Brooks. "We must be all right." The Dick Van Dyke Show helped Reiner land a starring role in the 1966 Cold War comedy, The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, said the New York Times. But he spent most of his career letting others get the laughs. Reiner directed box office hits such as 1977's Oh God, featuring George Burns as a down-to-earth deity, and 1979's The Jerk, his first of four movies starring Steve Martin. Reiner's later films, such as 1985's Summer Rental and 1990's Sibling Rivalry, were less successful, as were the two Broadway plays he directed. He returned to acting as an aging con man in the 2001 remake of Ocean's 11 and its two sequels. In his 90s, Reiner kept up a daily routine that included writing and tweeting about politics, said Vanity Fair, then having fellow widower Brooks over to his Beverly Hills home to eat dinner and watch Jeopardy on his massive TV. "I don't think I've ever had a better friend than Carl," Brooks said in a joint interview with Reiner earlier this year. "My God, the thought of being without him," Reiner responded, "the world would be too bleak." And we'll turn right over to the talking points page, starting with Trump's records. Roberts threads the needle. Chief Justice John Roberts has refused to make President Trump a king, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate.com. With twin rulings, Roberts rejected Trump's monarchical assertion of absolute immunity from two separate subpoenas for his tax returns and other personal financial records. "No citizen, not even the president, is categorically above the common duty to produce evidence," Roberts wrote in the majority opinion. But to shield the court from involvement in partisan politics, Roberts cannily threaded the needle by enabling Trump to avoid actually responding to the subpoenas before the election. In both 7-2 rulings, in which the court's four liberals were joined by conservative justices Roberts, Neil Gorsuch, and Brett Kavanaugh, the cases were sent back to lower courts so Trump could argue why these particular subpoenas are unjustified. One case involves New York District Attorney Cyrus Vance's investigation into hush money payments to two women who say they had affairs with Trump, said Pete Williams in NBCNews.com. In the other, House Democrats are seeking Trump's financial records for possible answers to a question special counsel Robert Mueller never answered. Did Trump borrow money from Russian entities or otherwise do business with them before he became president? The subpoenas demanded that Deutsche Bank, fined earlier for an illicit scheme to launder billions in Russian rubles, turn over its records on Trump, in hopes they might finally answer the question of whether foreign governments, including Russia, hold sway over him. The court's ruling might be bad news for Trump, the dirty businessman, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com, but it will push the day of reckoning beyond November 2020. That's all candidate Trump cares about. Forget about Trump, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The real import of the rulings is that the office of the presidency has now been significantly weakened. Now Congress can demand any record so long as it meets a new four-pronged test of relevancy established by Roberts. That's hardly enough to restrain a willful Congress or partisan judges, and the Vance ruling gives a tacit thumbs up to any of the nation's 2,300 local prosecutors to harass the president with subpoenas. As Justice Samuel Alito sensibly wrote in dissent, many of them are elected, and many prosecutors have ambitions for higher elected office. Joe and Hunter Biden better get ready for a blizzard of subpoenas. Harper's Letter, Liberals versus Woke Leftists. It was the letter that launched 1,000 tweets, said Lloyd Grove in the DailyBeast.com. In an open letter to Harper's Magazine, 153 writers, academics, and artists spoke out against the rise of a culture marked by intolerance of opposing views, a vogue for public shaming, and ostracism, and the tendency to dissolve complex policy issues into blinding moral certainty. Signed by such prominent figures as Salman Rushdie, Gloria Steinem, Malcolm Gladwell, Margaret Atwood, and Wynton Marsalis, the letter decried a stifling atmosphere of enforced conformity that metes out harsh punishment to those guilty of perceived transgressions, particularly on the topics of race, identity politics, privilege, and gender. The backlash was swift. Leftist critics called the letter writers thin-skinned dilettantes. Trans author Jennifer Flynn Boylan issued a public apology for signing, and Vox writer Emily Vander Werf, a trans woman, took aim at her liberal colleague Matthew Iglesias for signing the letter alongside anti-trans voices like J.K. Rowling, saying it made her feel less safe. The signers no doubt thought they were taking a courageous moral stand, said Jeff Yang at CNN.com. But an attack on political correctness coming from people with enormous public platforms feels like an affirmation of elitism and privilege. The letter boils down to a howl of anguish from a group that has suddenly found its views no longer treated with reverence, said Billy Bragg in TheGuardian.com. These long-standing cultural arbiters are not happy to be challenged on Twitter and other social media by a new generation of activists demanding accountability. The letter was their demand for a safe space. Tom Wolfe couldn't have devised a more pungent satire of mutual recriminations among liberal elites, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The letter accurately depicts the ferocious campaign of coerced conformity sweeping America's liberal institutions. And the overheated reaction just shows why it is necessary to begin with. Yes, the letter writers are protected by fame and institutional power, said letter signer Phoebe Maltz Bovey in WashingtonPost.com. But their status enables them to speak up about the dangers of cancel culture, which is most dangerous for less established writers, thinkers, and performers who are one misstep away from the loss of livelihood. In a very real sense, the letter is an attempt by the powerful to look out for the powerless. And here's a couple short notes. Almost 1,900 of the 4,000 inmates at San Quentin Prison in California, in addition to more than 200 staff members, have tested positive for COVID-19. 9 inmates have died, including at least 5 of the 670 prisoners on the facility's death row. The pandemic is sparing millions of wild animals from dying as roadkill, as the number of vehicles on the road has plunged by as much as 70%. A reporter at the University of California projected that as many as 200 million of the 1 billion animals killed annually on roads could survive because of the coronavirus. And we'll finish out the show today with a quote from Carl Reiner himself, quoted in Reuters.com. Mr. Reiner says, "Inviting people to laugh at you while you are laughing at yourself is a good thing to do. You may be the fool, but you are the fool in charge." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. The number is 919-832-5138.